It's 12 noon, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And, as promised, coming right up now, Animal Voices.
Good afternoon and welcome to Animal Voices. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are our co-hosts, All Art, John Pranger, and Carl Loskin. Our first guest today will be Marcy Mariarty, who is the Director of Cruelty Investigations for the British Columbia Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and we will be hearing from Marcy very shortly. Later in the show, Carl will be interviewing Bree, who is with the Burns Bog Conservation Society. And during the hour, our technician and announcer, Alan Jensen, will be providing musical interludes. And John Pranger will have some news items. So let's get on with the show. Over to All Art.
Okay, we have Marcy Mariarty. She has a degree in animal biology at UBC, and she went on to obtain a Bachelor of Law and practice in civil litigation. Now, her passion in animals and a desire to work in animal welfare, along with utilizing her legal background, led her to a career as the General Manager of Cruelty Investigations with the BCSPCA. In this position, she manages the special provincial constables who conduct over 6,000 cruelty investigations a year. Marcy, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Well, that's quite a good resume. Now, you've been working on a few issues, one of which is the legislative changes to the Wildlife Act, which involves some exotic animals. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, one of the advocacy issues and campaigns that the BCSPCA has been working on are submissions to the Wildlife Act. Minister Barry Penner in the Environment had opened up the Wildlife Act, which hasn't actually been looked at or revised in over 25 years, and called for submissions from various parties. So we at the BCSPCA felt that this was a perfect opportunity to address some of the lack of legislation regarding exotic animals in BC. It might surprise people, but there's actually no uniform provincial approach to address any of the health, animal welfare, and environmental issues regarding exotic species and their trade in BC.
Were any of these changes brought about by this recent thing with the tigers, that with the woman got mauled?
Well, it actually, the act had been opened up for submissions just prior to it, but the incident in Hundred Mile House highlights exactly why some sort of legislation needs to be in place, both the animal welfare side and the safety side. We're definitely concerned also about the humane treatment of all wildlife in captivity. And part of the submissions would go to the regulation and enforcement of care standards, the management of non-native species, and then the regulation of wildlife rehabilitation centers. Those were some of the main points that we wanted to touch on in this particular submission. And we hope that the government will actually take a look at our submissions and include them in the revision of the Wildlife Act.
Do you have some examples as to where things were lacking and how you used them to present your case?
Definitely. As I had mentioned, the fact that exotic animals are not covered under provincial legislation, and what that means to the general public is that anybody can go out and purchase a tiger or a lion or a caiman, alligator, and keep them as house pets without any sort of regulation. There are certain municipalities that do have bylaws banning exotics, but people simply move outside of the municipal boundary and they are able to keep those animals. There's also no set standard of care for facilities that do house these animals. So one of the suggestions that we were making is that the definition of wildlife currently being used in the Act should be expanded to include all native, non-native, and exotic vertebrates and invertebrates, so that there would be they would be included under the Act. We're also looking to have a prohibited species list, and that would be a list of exotic species that should be prohibited from private possession or breeding, for that matter, or trafficking, and that certain exceptions would be made for accredited facilities, but that there would be a set of standards that, that those facilities would have to meet. Mm-hmm. It's almost shocking that this hasn't been in place before. And we actually look to Alberta, of all places, and their Wildlife Act, which actually does have some pretty pretty good standards set out for facilities that do house exotic animals.
And what would those exceptions be that you mentioned?
Well, it would places like the aquarium, zoos, or facilities that feel that they are wanting to keep these animals for educational purposes, although I think that term gets tossed around a little bit too much. But there would have to be a definition as to what would make a facility an appropriate facility to have one of the prohibited species.
Now, you know, when you mention the aquarium or even zoos or anything like this, I mean, the thing that comes to my mind, you know, working in the film industry, is mm-hmm. we certainly have a medium that can get out there and film animals close up and personal, and why would we need zoos and aquariums when we can view those?
Well, that's definitely one of the arguments, and a good argument. I think that, you know, we at the BCSBCA definitely are opposed to the use of any sort of animals and exotic animals in entertainment. And unfortunately, sometimes facilities that say that they're an education facility are more in it for the entertainment. For instance, this particular situation in 100 Mile House, the tigers were being kept for photographs, for movie industry, and that would definitely not, in our submission, meet the definition of an accredited facility.
Well, does education meet the definition? I mean, this is the same thing that I'm talking about. If you have the medium of film that will allow you to get close and personal to animals, why that should not be sufficient education enough? Why do you need to actually see it in person?
And I would agree in part on that for sure. Unfortunately, or as part of our submissions, at least we felt that if the facilities itself aren't going to be banned, that at least there would be a set of standards that would be out there that facilities would have to adhere to. So then you are at least ensuring good animal welfare. So those are some of the issues that we were dealing with in our submissions. We also were dealing with wildlife rehabilitation and the fact that we would recommend that there be a wildlife rehabilitation accreditation program so that the provincial government would conduct inspections and issue permits for these such facilities.
Well, that's interesting. I guess you can only do it an increment at a time.
Yes, exactly.
I'm a little appalled at the resistance to banning it outright. But,
mm-hmm. Well, in fact, the Alberta legislation on wildlife doesn't actually have a prohibited species list. And so we're asking the BC government to go one step further and to have a prohibited list, which seems logical on both a public safety, which is always something government likes to draft legislation about. But for our purposes, of course, we're looking at it on an animal welfare perspective.
Well, of course, it always ends up being about us, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Our safety, our welfare. What about the animals? Yeah.
So that's one of the campaigns and initiatives. And we would invite the public to visit our website at www.spca.bc.ca, where they can read the actual submission. There's a summary of the submission, and then the submission that was submitted to the Ministry of Environment, and then there's a letter that people can sign in support of these changes to the Wildlife Act, and we really encourage the public to visit that site and inform themselves and get involved.
That's great. Let's move on to, you've got, you're the general manager of Cruelty Investigations.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, in this position, I oversee approximately now 45 special provincial constables, who are appointed under the Police Act to conduct cruelty investigations throughout the province. We're mandated under the provincial legislation, the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, to investigate instances where there are complaints of animals in distress. Our constables go out and issue orders, provide education, and unfortunately, in situations where animal owners are not willing to comply or able to comply with our orders, we have the ability to obtain a search warrant and seize animals. And then there are provisions whereby we may not return animals to that individual. And also, we recommend charges to Crown Council. Some people think that we actually charge the individuals ourselves. We don't. In BC, it's Crown Council who'd actually charge an individual with an offense under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act the Criminal Code.
Could you give us some examples of, say a type of cruelty situation that you would encounter and then the type of charge that would be laid on that?
Definitely. Well, there's a number of different, I'd say, categories of cruelty investigations. There's, of course, the brutal, intentional cruelty whereby, in a recent case, an individual harmed a rabbit intentionally, and so he was charged with animal cruelty, and he hasn't faced a conviction yet, but in that particular case, we would be going for an outright ban on owning animals, and we would be seeking some restitution costs. Then there's the cases where it's a situation, we deal with a lot of animal hoarding issues. And so one particular case comes to mind whereby a woman had over 35 dogs in her custody. And while she may have loved those dogs, she was not capable of, in fact, looking after them properly. So we did seize animals in that case. We did recommend charges, and she was convicted. And actually, this case was a very good case for us. She did receive a lifetime ban on owning animals except for one dog, but she also received court-ordered counseling to help deal with the issue of hoarding, animal hoarding. She actually was fined and a restitution order of approximately $11,000. So that's one of the cases. And then there are other cases of abandonment, inability to provide vet treatment that's needed, so a dog who's hit by a car and the person, for whatever reason, usually it's they can't afford it, decides that they're going to do self-treatment at home, and obviously that's not okay, and that individual needs to take responsibility. So those are some cases. And I know I'd wanted to touch on puppy mills because it seems in the last few weeks we've had a number of seizures or cases involving large numbers of puppies specifically that were used for profit. And it is unfortunate, well, I'd use a disgusting is more appropriate term, that people are still buying dogs and puppies and kittens from facilities which the only explanation is they get from a large breeding facility where usually the conditions are substandard.
In any of these cases, have you come across animals that have been killed, maliciously killed, and what kind of charges are there for that?
In fact, that's quite rare, which is a good thing. The outright intentional harming of animals, I would say, makes up a small percentage of our cases. And in that case, though, in those cases, we would recommend charges under the Criminal Code also. The Criminal Code deals with intentional cases of cruelty. Unfortunately, though, the punishment under the Criminal Code is actually far less than what we can actually get under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act. The maximum is a 2-year term, a $2,000 fine and or 6 months in prison, and only a 5-year ban on owning animals, whereas under our provincial legislation, we can get a lifetime ban. And in those cases, we would be definitely seeking a lifetime ban on owning animals and a term in jail.
Well, it's interesting the term in jail is so short. Again, it speaks to how we consider animals as far less important in their survival and their welfare than human beings.
Well, and property, exactly.
Yeah, their property. They, you know, certainly if someone killed a human being, they might be looking at a life sentence.
Exactly.
But an animal, 6 months and a fine and just a ban on owning animals for a number of years, that seems...
It is woefully inadequate, and we are, there's a push on the federal level for changes to legislation, but also on a provincial level. We've sought changes to our Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act to make it more effective. And it's not simply just having stronger penalties. I think that's where sometimes people get all worked up in the stronger penalties, but I would say what good is an act that's ineffective if you can never get a conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we're trying to address provincially is strengthening of our act to make it more effective and, in fact, increase the deterrence for people to either neglect or not take responsibility for their care of their animals. And so we have another campaign, the End Animal Cruelty Campaign, that listeners can read about at www.endanimalcruelty.com, that's all one word, and read about some of the changes that we are seeking to the provincial legislation. And that would also include for us a ticketing provision. So we'd be able to ticket an animal owner for failing to comply with an order from a special provincial constable.
Do you have any kind of program in place? I'm just thinking about maybe some elderly people who maybe are not through on purpose, but perhaps not taking care of their beloved pet as well as they could be, and they love their pet, and mm-hmm. their pet's a companion for them, but, you know, whether they have some mental illness or whether they just are getting a little bit of dementia mm-hmm. or something, they may not be properly caring for their animal. Is there anything in place that would allow somebody to go in and help them care for their animal properly but keep it?
Well, we come across that all the time. I was actually just up in Prince George on an investigation where our constables try and work with the animal owner in this particular case. She had 5 cats that were just covered in fleas, and what we try and do in that particular case is work with the individual to try and provide low-cost spay-neuter to help get involved different agencies or other groups in their community that may be able to, you know, provide subsidized vet care, and in some situations, it may be limiting the person to 1 or 2 animals instead of 5 or 6. So there's nothing formal in place at the BCSPCA, but there are many community initiatives, and we do have spay-neuter, low-cost spay-neuter initiatives in many communities. So that is always the goal. You know, a human-animal bond is what we want to be promoting, and unfortunately there are situations where for whatever reason animal owners aren't able to properly look after their pets.
What would you suggest that the public, if they suspect that an animal is not getting proper care, would you suggest that they go and try to talk to the person first, or would they just contact you, or how would you recommend they deal with that?
Well, they can always call in to their local shelter and report it. Depending on the situation, if it's a neighbor situation and you notice that their dog isn't getting out as often as you think, you could simply offer to walk the dog or ask them about it. Our constables will always attend at a cruelty investigation, and the first thing we have an obligation to do is ask the animal owner about the situation and provide them with some opportunity to relieve the distress. So if a person suspects that there is a neglect situation, then they can either approach the animal owner on their own, but also I would say call us and we can have a constable come out.
Now, I guess it could be a little bit of a touchy situation if you have a neighbor who goes over and talks to their neighbor about their animal, and then nothing seems to be done, and then they call you, and then constables come over. Then now there's a war in the neighborhood going on,
yes,
between the neighbors. So this is this.
That's a difficult situation. We don't release the name of the individual who complains. However, of course, if your neighbor's already spoken to you about something, then they're going to think it's the individual. Obviously, if there's any safety issues involved, personal safety, we encourage people just to give us a call first.
Okay. We have to wrap this up. Is there any last-minute comments you'd like to make, Marcy?
Just that we really, really want people to get behind our Wildlife Act submissions and inform themselves about many of the issues going on in this province that deal with wildlife and exotic animals. And so if they can visit our website and read about our submissions. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak again on this show.
You're welcome. Could you give out your website one more time?
Sure. It's www.spca.bc.ca.
All right. Well, thank you very much for informing us of what you're doing. That was very interesting. And we'll have you back again in the future and give us some more updates on what you're doing.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, thank you for that, alert. It's always interesting to hear from Marcy. She has a lot going at the SPCA. We know that. You have been listening to an interview with Marcy Moriarty, who is the Director of Cruelty Investigations for the BC Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And this is CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. You're listening to Animal Voices. Now, Alan, could we have a little bit of music?
That's a bit of Hugh Masekela, Carl, one of your country folk, who is going to be here at the Mission Folk Festival. The Mission Folk Festival is happening July 27th, 28th, and 29th, and Hugh Masekela will be amongst the people who are there. And over to Marge.
Bit of good news from the Vancouver Humane Society. I was talking to Bruce Passmore, who's the person who's working for the animal, laying hens, and there's another giant step forward in Vancouver. The British Columbia Institute of Technology is going free-range eggs only. So that's another great step for the chickens that have long been forgotten. Now, Carl, you have something?
Yes. Well, you know, this week's Georgia Strait has an article from a guy called Carl Luskin.
And
we don't know. So it's they don't publish too many letters. So quite thrilled that they're dealing with the issue of our provincial government wanting to increase the number of hunters by 200,000. Anyway, the letter reads with a headline. It says, "Liberals want kids to feel the thrill of the kill." And this is the letter. "The BC government proposed amendment to the Wildlife Act is equivalent to making a call to girls, boys, and sports shooting enthusiasts to conserve and protect the environment and bring your gun. The amendment seeks to recruit more children to sustain the sport of hunting, which has been losing participants of all ages for two decades. Junior hunting licenses in BC are available at the age of 10. And I wrote, "I know of a youth who shot a deer and a bear when he was 14. In this frenzy of streamlining regulations and encouraging the sport of hunting, I'm concerned about the public safety when children carry guns. In many European countries, no ambitious politician would want to be seen with a hunting rifle in his hands and a cuddly animal in his sights. it seems that in BC, politicians go to great lengths to get seen doing just that. And it's signed Carl Luskin. So this week's Georgia Strait.
10 years of age?
Yes.
Oh,
and,
my Lord.
And, of course, many of these animals, when people are novice hunters, they get injured and they die in silent agony in the forest.
Yes.
It's an encouragement which I think an amendment which is not encouraged by us.
Well, how does our gun regulations fit into this? I mean, I would think that that would be prohibited just from the gun legislation.
Well, the gun legislation is that you can buy licenses to kill a bear, to shoot a bear, for $7 if you're a BC resident. Of course, it's quite hefty if you're a non-resident.
So that's the license for it. But what about the license for owning a firearm?
Well, I'm not quite sure the difference between this, of course, this whole brouhaha about registry, but I'm not sure whether that includes, I think that's only for handguns, and I think it's quite different for hunting guns, which are, you know, you can't exactly pack in your back pocket.
It's not only for handguns, but what obviously is true is that there's no age limit on the legislation. I mean, there are restrictions, but clearly, something we didn't know, there's no age limit. If the government of BC can say that 10-year-olds can go hunting, that means that it's legal for a 10-year-old to pack a weapon and go out and shoot, which is very surprising indeed, because you have to be 16 to drive a car, right? And other things, you know, and 19 to drink, but at 10, you're allowed to go and pack a deadly weapon. That's quite surprising indeed.
Oh, that's appalling, absolutely.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, John, you have something short there.
Yeah, sure. Let's see. India is appealing to the world to keep the tiger trade ban. India will appeal to the UN Wildlife Forum to retain a ban on trading in tiger parts despite Chinese lobbying to legalize trade in organs of the endangered big cats, the government said on Tuesday. China has been pressing countries to support lifting the ban imposed in 1993 and last week said it would allow trade in parts from captive bred tigers if a review proved it would reduce poaching and help tigers worldwide. The African nations are deadlocked on elephant ivory because Kenya and Mali reduced their demands to extend a 1989 world ban on the trade in elephant ivory, but ran into deadlock on Tuesday at the UN Forum with other African nations who want tightly controlled trade. And hoping to avert an acrimonious public row among African states, the Conference on International Trade in Endangered Species put off debate about elephants until Wednesday or Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and thank you, John. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And on the line right now we have Bree, who is a education coordinator for the Burns Bog Conservation Society. Hello, Bree. Hello, Bree.
Hello.
Yes, good to hear from you. And maybe you have a wonderful presence there in Delta. Maybe you can give us an idea of what is a bog and what is the significance of the Burns Bog.
Okay, sure. A bog is mainly a wetland with lots of water and very little nutrients. And it's a bit different from a forest in that it doesn't have any trees. And the importance of the bog, there's tons and tons of important reasons we want to protect it.
Can't hear very
well. So it's an elevated peat moss bog, is it?
Mm-hmm, a raised peat bog.
Which is very unique, isn't it? I mean, there's only a few of those in the world.
Mm-hmm, it is.
And tell us, how comes it got raised and a bit about the history of its formation?
Oh, my goodness.
A little higher.
Okay, it's the only known raised peat bog in a Mediterranean climate.
Feedback.
And it's the largest undeveloped urban landmass in North America. So basically how a bog forms is when the glaciers recede, it leaves a big hole in the ground, and then over time that fills with water and plants, and then over time again the plants fill the water, and you get peat, which is the dead and decaying plant and animal material. And over time, the layers and layers of peat pile up, and so Burns Bog is now a domed formation.
Now, that's the peat moss that a lot of people use in their gardens. It gets dug up and distributed all over to create acidity when people are growing blueberries and stuff.
Mm-hmm,
but do you recommend that people actually use peat moss and, you know, it's a diminution of the peat worldwide?
No, we don't encourage the use of peat moss, and we have a cute little saying that goes, for peat's sake, don't use peat. And we've actually published a guide, Alternatives to Peat Moss, for gardeners to use. So there's a whole bunch of ideas on other things you can use instead of peat.
Well, since it's gardening time right now, maybe let's have it.
Mm-hmm, right. It's a whole guide on it that's for sale from our office.
What would be the main alternative to using peat moss?
We have a few opportunities. You can use the bark, or we have cocoa earth. There's animal manure and a whole bunch of things.
Straw.
Yeah.
Straw. Good, good. Now, you have a tremendous education program. You're the education coordinator,
mm-hmm.
and you take groups out there to the Bernsborg, which is, let me give you an idea of the significant, before we go on to what you people do, the significance of the Bernsborg to the air. I mean, it's been likened to the lungs of the Fraser Valley there and Vancouver. I mean, it's the largest urban landmass in North America of its kind. Undeveloped urban landmass.
Yes.
So maybe just give us a scope on that, because it's so close to city. What is it doing? Creating oxygen or absorbing whatever?
Well, basically, all the plants and trees, when they grow, they take in that carbon dioxide and they give us back oxygen to breathe. And if you saw or smelt the smoke from the fire in 2005, that smoke made it all the way to Vancouver Island and the United States. So you can visually see how far the oxygen from the bog does reach.
Now, also, the danger is then lightning can strike in the area, and a fire can start there, but even though it's so moist, it's really difficult to put it out.
Right, right. Yeah, it's about an 8,000-acre area, so to get fire crew in there is a little bit of a challenge. Fire's not necessarily a bad thing for the bog, though. It did burn down lots of the trees in the bog that aren't supposed to be there. But when it gets into the peat, it can start to burn underground until it reaches the water table.
Now, there was, of course, the garbage dump there for all the garbage in Vancouver was going into an area. Is that still continuing?
Yes.
It is?
Yeah.
So if it's a raised bog, and that means all this garbage, decomposing gases and toxins, would it spread to the whole area, or would it be confined?
It is the largest landfill west of Toronto, so it does take in a lot of our garbage. It's not being spread out anymore. They're just going to build it up, so it's going to be a kind of a mini mountain, I guess you could say. When you drive over the Alex Fraser Bridge, you can see that big brown mound. That's the landfill, and they're just going to build it up higher and higher, add more layers on it. But they do have a double ditch system around the landfill to catch any leachate that does come out of the landfill. And then that water gets treated at the treatment plant.
Right. So there is some kind of prevention happening there. Now, how many acres is this whole Bernsborg? And in total, how many acres is it?
It was originally about 10 to 12,000 acres. And it's about 8,000 to 10,000 acres now.
And recently in 2004, the provincial government purchased 5,025 acres, but there's still some left over in private hands.
Mm-hmm. There's about just under 500 acres left to be
purchased. Now, who owns that, and is there any movement to complete the purchase of the land in there to make the Bernsborg a totally sacred place?
That's in the works, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. I'm not quite sure. It's MSW Dallas Lands. I'm not quite sure. I'm not familiar with that.
Right. Now, it's a big piece of land like that has been a sanctuary for many of the wildlife there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, that it skirts the Fraser River,
mm-hmm,
which
right.
is very significant. That's Maybe you can tell us something about the relationship there.
Sure. A lot of people don't think about the relationship between the bog and the Fraser River, but there is definitely an important one. There's a food chain. When it rains on the bog, that water gets washed out to the Fraser River, and on its way, that water picks up iron from the bog, and the phytoplankton in the Fraser River eat up that iron, and then the fish eat the phytoplankton. So that's one of the important food chains we have. And also, you've probably heard how our waters are warming up due to global warming. But when it rains in the bog and all that water washes out...
I think I read something about it in the papers maybe last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's everywhere. But when the water washes through the bog, it gets a chance to cool down before it goes into the Fraser River. And so the bog keeps the temperature of the Fraser River at a suitable... that fish can withstand, because they're very sensitive to temperature changes. And it also filters the pollution out as well.
Right. Now, what kind of animals live there? I mean, there must be all kinds of magical birds.
Yeah, we've got some really neat birds. We've got the sandhill crane, and that's actually the logo for our society. The great blue heron and the peregrine falcon are ones we usually talk about on our tours. But that's the Burns Bog lies on the Great Pacific Flyway, which is one of four major migration routes. So over 1.5 million birds stop here every year and in Boundary Bay on their way from Alaska to California.
Right.
Tons and tons of birds.
What a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
But
so,
you have... John,
no,
has
I was
question.
Wondering if this is ever developed, what would happen to the birds? They'd simply become extinct.
No. Yeah, well, you can't go a long distance without stopping, so they're going to have to stop somewhere, and without a stop, they probably won't make that migration.
But the Burns Bog will never be developed.
Hopefully not. Probably that 5,000 acres is not to be developed on, but we're just trying to encourage more education.
I had a question about the development in terms of the highway system that's being put in,
mm-hmm.
and part of the, you know, the twinning of the Port Man, and then access to Roberts Bank coal jetty and the new terminal that's being built there.
Mm-hmm.
There is a road that's going around the bog, is there not?
Mm-hmm. There is, the South Fraser Perimeter Road.
And as far as you know, is that going to end up being a threat to the water, that system that runs through the bog?
Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure, but we do have concerns that it will disrupt the hydrology and the natural water flow between the bog and the river, as well as the migration routes for some of the wildlife. The migration corridors, they go back and forth from the bog to the river.
Well, it also causes a tremendous amount of pollution from all
definitely.
The tremendous number of trucks that are going to be going on the South Fraser Perimeter
right.
Road.
Yeah.
But, you know, Eliza Olson and yourselves and all the volunteers that go to the Conservation Society and have been so successful in creating awareness of the people. And I think the people of Vancouver really want that to be a sacred preserve because of its uniqueness.
Mm-hmm.
But, you're going to have Burns Bog Day fairly soon, so
yep.
maybe you can encourage some of our listeners to come out there and tell us what you'll be doing. Will we be meeting you, and what encouragement can you give us?
Sure. International Bog Day, we hold that every year in July, and it's coming up on Sunday, July 29th from 10:30 until 3, and it's held in the parking lot of the Great Pacific Forum Planet Ice in Delta.
Right, and is there a cost involved, Bree?
No, it's a free family event with lots of exhibits and children's performers and entertainment and bog tours and food, tons of stuff.
Now, a few years ago, I was permitted to go with a group, and it was really raining, and there was only about half a dozen people going on the tour, and we were invited to drop the clothes and jump into the... Pierre Pietmas, you know, we weren't exactly expecting that.
Right.
And so only about three of us dared the cold and the wind and the cooler thing. But, you know, when it was said that in Europe, this is a preserve for the best of spas. It's a total health thing that is so unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I must tell you, I crawled out of there. But I looked a bit like a bear because all of the peat moss just stuck to me, you know.
Right.
And, well, you know, there was nothing very private there or anything, you know. It was totally covered by peat moss.
Oh,
it was
for
wonderful.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately we can't do that on our tours anymore. Once the 5,000 acres was purchased, we can't go into the central bog. So now we just walk on the boardwalks of the Delta Nature Reserve.
Well, you know, that's so you also have summer day camps, and is that ongoing right now?
Yeah, we've got children aged 6 to 12 in the bog on a weekly basis throughout the summer, and they're just exploring the trails and the plants and animals and learning about the environment.
And if say, somebody wants to, can't make it on Burns Bog Day, the July the 29th, can they come any week and look on your webpage?
It's all on our website, www.burnsbog.org. Or they can give the society a call at 604-572-0373.
Burnsbog.org. Mm-hmm. Great webpage, and there's all kinds of information to welcome you to explore the world that's giving us lots of oxygen and very kind people who have made an urban sanctuary here on the Fraser Valley and the Fraser Estuary. Thank you, Bree.
Thank you.
For all you do and for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye for now. Over to Marge.
Thank you for that, Carl. You have been listening to an interview with Bree, who is with the Burns Bog Conservation Society. Now, could we have a little interlude, brief interlude, Alan? Thank you. Here's another item that I think follows up on the concerns over the Burns Bog, and this is the concerns over the boreal forest in Alberta because of the tar sands project. Now, there is a proposed Earl Tar Sands project coming up, and it's located in the Athabasca region north of Fort McMurray, and it has now been given the green light by government to proceed later this year. And it will mean stripping 200 square kilometers of northern boreal forest. This project could put already endangered species, including woodland caribou, at greater risk. Now, Simon Dyer of the Pembina Institute has this to say about it. Alberta's boreal forest is a global treasure that is under siege by the tar sands development. The Curl Tar Sands project will transform an undisturbed mosaic of evergreen and deciduous forests and wetlands, natural habitat to wolves, black bears, and songbirds, into a strip mine complete with toxic tailing ponds. Now, this is particularly egregious to me when I went on to read, this is taken from the Sierra Legal Defense Fund newsletter, that the taxpayers of Canada subsidize the oil industry by $1.4 billion a year. Now, the Legal Defense Fund has been campaigning against this for some time, and they've taken the issue, made a presentation to the government in 2005 in order to have something done about this. Finally, in the 2007 budget, Jim Flaherty, the Minister of Finance in the federal government, announced that a phase-out of the accelerated capital cost allowance program will begin in 2011, and the final phase-out will be 2015. So we are still giving billions of dollars away. Now, over to John.
Hi, thanks, Marge. A couple of things from the Georgia Straits, some events going on in town. Here's one. Natural Animal Wellness. Julie Ann Lee discusses homeopathy, vaccination, and raw food diets. July 23rd, 7 to 9 p.m., Wild at Heart Raw Food for Pets. That's at 2670 West Broadway, and the fee is $15, $15 to $20. And the phone number is 734-9453, wildatheartpets.com. Can we live on a 100-mile diet? Structured debate and general discussion hosted by the Work Less Party, July 24th at 7 p.m. at the Britannia Library. That's 1661 Napier.
That's on Tuesday.
That's Tuesday, huh? Okay. And how severe is the global ecological crisis? The World Federalist Movement Canada presents Douglas College philosophy professor Leonard Angel, who will ask tough questions about the global economic or ecological crisis and explain the global hectare measure and other key notions used by ecologists. That's July 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Unitarian Church at 949 West 94th. It's free admission, free parking. And one other thing was Stanley Park Recovery Plan for Vancouver's crown jewel. Vancouver AM Tourism Association presents a breakfast meeting with Vancouver Park Board Chief or Chair Ian Robertson, July 20th at 7 a.m. Well, I'm not going there. Yeah, well, and I have an item here, if there's time, for the long version. What time is it, Alan? 46.
Well, we have 10 minutes.
10 minutes, very good. Well, there's a you can read this book online. It's called Toxicity Testing in the 21st Century, A Vision and a Strategy. And it's put out by the National Academies of Science, and they're advisors to the Nation on Science, Engineering, and Medicine. And they've come out with a news item, and you can read the full report on the nationalacademies.org website. It's www.8.nationalacademies.org. And the report reads as follows. Recent advances, or the title is Report Calls for New Directions and Innovative Approaches in Testing Chemicals for Toxicity to Humans. Recent advances, it reads, in systems biology, testing in cells and tissues, and related scientific fields offer the potential to fundamentally change the way chemicals are tested for risks they may pose to humans, says a new report from the National Research Council. The report outlines a new approach that would rely less heavily on animal studies and instead focus on in vitro methods that evaluate chemicals' effects on biological processes using cells, cell lines, or cellular components, preferably of human origin. The new approach would generate more relevant data to evaluate risk people face, expand the number of chemicals that could be scrutinized, and reduce the time, money, and animals involved in testing, said the committee that wrote the report. Today, researchers typically test the safety of commercial chemicals, pesticides, and other substances by administering large doses to groups of animals and observing them for symptoms of disease. They kill half the animals, by the way, that they test on. It's called the LD50 test, which is a lethal dose 50, at which 50% of the animals die from toxicity. And these tests inform decisions about whether and how to regulate the chemicals used. But how relevant the animal tests are for humans, usually exposed at much lower doses, has often been called into question. Moreover, the current approach is time-consuming and costly, resulting in an overburdened system that leaves many chemicals untested, despite potential human exposure to them, the report observes. Recognizing these limitations, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, which oversees the testing of many agricultural, commercial, and industrial chemicals, asked the Research Council to develop a new approach and strategy for toxicity testing. The report recommends an approach that would take advantage of rapidly evolving scientific understanding of how genes, proteins, and small molecules interact to maintain normal cell function and how some of these interactions can be perturbed in ways that could lead to health problems. Specifically, the new testing approach would focus on toxicity pathways, cellular pathways that, when sufficiently perturbed, are expected to lead to adverse health effects. The committee recommends the use of high-throughput assays, which are rapid, automated experiments that can test hundreds or thousands of chemicals over a wide range of concentrations to evaluate chemicals' effects on these toxicity pathways. On the basis of data from these and other experiments, researchers could develop models to describe responses in toxicity pathways and other models to estimate the human exposure necessary to produce responses in these. pathways. Over time, the need for traditional animal testing could be greatly reduced and possibly even eliminated someday, says the report. And here they contradict themselves entirely. For the foreseeable future, they say, however, targeted tests in animals would need to be used to complement the in vitro test because current methods cannot yet adequately mirror the metabolism of a whole animal. When I sent this to my friend Dr. John Pippin, who is the senior researcher for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine based in Washington, D.C., who are opposed to animal experiments, and he said... what is so very hard to get these people to acknowledge is that it's no good to use the wrong whole animal. And that is exactly what we're doing when we're not experimenting on a human being. We're experimenting on an animal which has absolutely no predictive value to us. So we cannot tell whether a substance is going to be harmful or helpful to a human being by testing it on rats.
Well, John,
Yes, go ahead.
That's one of the reasons why in the past, you know, I've been talking about the stem cell research that's going on in Britain, why they are trying to mix in human cells in with the animal cells so that sheep's livers and hearts and other organs are now partly human, and that's the justification for saying, well, now this is a viable experiment because it's partly human.
Yeah, and they think that by creating a monster like that, that they've solved the problem of rejection of organs of tissues. They haven't, in fact, solved the problem. They've gotten further away from it because they've created now a creature who is supposed to tell them everything they want to know, and it can't.
No, and I've heard you say in the past, which I thought was a great way, and it said it all, and you said a rat can't tell you when it's got a headache.
Exactly, or a toothache, or anything else subjective like that, or pain.
Exactly.
It can react, but how are you to measure that? And yet these people think they can measure it by some sort of electrical activity or something.
Yeah,
but
right.
It's totally misleading.
Yeah, can it tell you if it's cold? It's numb.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for that, John.
Oh, okay.
Now, here's something a little more positive. Maybe we can end on a higher note. This is an announcement from Sierra Legal, and it's applauding a decision made by the federal government to halt a seismic testing project proposed by the fjords and inlets of BC Central Coast. A coalition of marine conservation groups, including Sierra Legal, mounted a public campaign last year to stop the Batholith's project in its tracks. The controversial testing would have involved firing dozens of explosively loud air guns into the water every minute, 24 hours a day for 3 weeks. Can you imagine that? In March, the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council agreed and withdrew its funding for the proposal based on a lack of evidence that the testing would not harm local marine life, including the humpback whales and salmon stocks. It's amazing how all these groups have to continue fighting government, really, isn't it? Because at the basis, this shouldn't even be considered as a possibility when you consider the endangerment to the marine life.
Do we really live in a democracy is what you're asking,
right? Well, yes, that's right. But I remember reading about that and thought, oh, my Lord, what's going to happen to these animals? And it would drive them crazy, if nothing else, wouldn't it? Even if they managed to survive it.
Yeah, it almost seems like what not only do we have to raise people's consciousness with regards to animal issues, but we also need to come at it from another direction. We need to teach people how to come out of their self-centeredness and how to stop numbing themselves with the lifestyles that doesn't allow them to come out of their self-centeredness, to think beyond themselves, to see that there's another world out there that's got to be paid attention to, and how that benefits them to extend their consciousness beyond their own little box that they call themselves.
We're really one part of that, one small part of that, ever getting larger, however, in our numbers.
Well, can you really even trust all the groups that purport to be defenders of animals? I see here that the Vice President of Animal Research Issues Section of the Humane Society of the United States and Coordinator International Council for Animal Protection is also signed off on this report, which is calling for more animal experimentation. Now, they're probably addicted to the notion of reducing and refining and reusing animals, but they won't acknowledge the truth that it is irrelevant to human welfare. And, but here they are. They're sitting on this board, just as they are in Canada, sitting on the CCAC, the Canadian Council on Animal Care. The Federation of Humane Society is there as the public input. But they are not actually, they are saying exactly the same thing as the researchers are saying. We need animal experiments, but we should look for ways to reduce them. So that's a betrayal to me of the animals and to people. And I say I have a big issue with the Humane Society of the United States coming out and endorsing a report like that. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have a problem with that?
Well, I do. I mean, how can you better your own consciousness while supporting this cruelty and this pain mm-hmm. that is being subjected upon these animals? How does that benefit human beings to go along with that? How does that benefit the evolvement of your consciousness, the evolvement of your life? Right. How do you come out of your own suffering when you perpetrate or go along with and stand by and do nothing about the suffering of animals or anything you might deem as lesser than you, whether it be, you know, the junkies or the homeless people or anybody that you may deem. I mean, we have to look out. And I mean, Mother Teresa, I've mentioned this before. Mother Teresa, she took care of the poorest of the poor, the least of the least, the sickest of the sick. And this was a great, powerful woman. I mean, politicians and people who were in their business suits who have tons of money would stand by in awe as she would walk through the aisle in the midst of them. So this woman had an understanding of the importance of taking care of the least, and it's that thing of where she said when she was taking care of them, she was asked, she said, well, to me, I am taking care of Jesus in his distressing disguise, because she understood that statement, what you do to the least of my brethren, you have done to me. And that's why she said, I am taking care of Jesus in his distressing disguise. So if we could understand the things that are being done to animals and any creature out there that we consider less than, we first of all have to adjust our idea and not consider them as having less rights to survival and a life than we do, but we need to take care of them, and then we might then start to get an understanding of what Mother Teresa understood or any great saint understood.
What you say is absolutely true, but unfortunately if we see what people do to other people, let alone what they do to other species, it's going to be a while before we raise the level of consciousness. We have to wrap things up.
When decisions like that are in the heads of our superiors, it's no wonder that the morality of the general society is falling very low. And we can see what happens when we turn animals into drug addicts, that it's not helping the drug addicts out in the street. They are increasing in numbers, and it's only because we insist on this useless study of animals rather than people.
Right, very interesting. I guess we are going to have to chop it off right now. Thank you all for listening, and you are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial. The program is Animal Voices. We will be back next Friday at 12 noon. Please join us then.